Now from the KSFR newsroom, at noon looks at the top local news headlines for this Thursday, September 26th. State Senate Majority Leader Michael Sanchez is calling for Human Services Department Secretary Sidney Squires' resignation. Sanchez says Squires' written response to a draft Hunger Task Force report shows a lack of understanding of both her job and the people she serves. After reading the report, Squire wrote in an email that there has never been any significant evidence of hunger in New Mexico, nor is there any at present. Squire says the focus should instead be on providing proper nutrition to citizens, and that expanding government food programs is not productive. The Santa Fe City Council last night postponed any vote on private redevelopment of the old Manderfield School on Canyon Road. Prospective buyers have been seeking rezoning that would permit the long vacant facility to house residential units and art studios. Original plans also called for a small cafe. Nearby residents have balked at the enterprise, saying it will change the character of the neighborhood. City Council moved to send the matter back to the city's planning commission. Meanwhile, as expected and without dissent, Santa Fe City Council has given approval to expanded areas of beer sales and consumption at Fort Marcy Park's semi-pro Fuego ball games. Beer sales were an original requirement for having the team make Santa Fe its home base. A small fenced-in beer garden was established that quickly earned the nickname Beer Prison. Game-goers will now wear wristbands indicating if they're of legal age to consume no more than 3 drinks per game. A New Mexico State Police spokesperson says searchers have found the 4 missing hikers in the subject of a search in the Sandia Mountains this morning. Sergeant Adam Gutierrez says Albuquerque police received a call from a man saying he and 3 other people, along with 3 dogs, were lost and not prepared for the night. He says all were located just before 8 a.m. and they are now in the process of escorting them out of the mountains. Gutierrez adds that all 4 appear to be in good condition. The New Mexico Department of Health has today confirmed a case of plague in a 52-year-old man from Santa Fe County. The Department of Health says this is the 3rd human case of plague in New Mexico and the U.S. this year. An environmental investigation will take place at the man's home to look for ongoing risk to others in the surrounding area. Plague is a bacterial disease of rodents that is generally transmitted to humans through flea bites, but can also be transmitted by direct contact with infected animals, including rodents, wildlife, and pets. Even with pleas from Santa Fe Mayor David Koss and Senator Tom Udall, the U.S. Postal Service is moving ahead with its plans to vacate the downtown Santa Fe post office for new digs at either San Busco Market Center or on the corner of West Alameda and Guadalupe Streets. Today's New Mexican quotes a Postal Service spokesman saying the agency is negotiating with another Santa Fe landlord. Koss and Udall have expressed concern about the impact the move would have on the city's downtown core. It's a green light from the New Mexico Environment Department for the Waste Isolation Pilot Plant, also known as WIP, near Carlsbad. Their annual permitting process has been completed with the required on-site inspection. As part of that process, various records and documents such as monitoring data, training records, and calibration records were requested by the Environment Department. They say that WIP takes its regulatory compliance very seriously. The facility is charged with storage of transuranic radioactive waste, so toxic it requires permanent entombment. A public hearing is set for next week in Albuquerque that could have broad ramifications for the 75 Mexican gray wolves still surviving in Arizona and New Mexico. A federal proposal would allow release of captive-bred wolves into the Gila National Forest in New Mexico and allow wolves to roam outside of current boundaries. However, if they stray north of I-40 or south of I-10, they would be recaptured and returned to the prescribed area. Animal rights advocates say that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service plan denies the wolves access to suitable habitats. And weather for Santa Fe? Mostly sunny today with highs in the low to mid-70s. Clouds on the increase tonight with a 30% chance for precipitation after midnight. Mostly cloudy tomorrow with a 40% chance for morning showers and thunderstorms and highs in the upper 60s. Meanwhile, the current Santa Fe temperature now stands at 68 degrees. This is Dan Garrity for KSFR News. Much more of At Noon for you coming up in just a moment.
Support comes from New Mexico Educators Federal Credit Union, where the more you participate in your not-for-profit financial cooperative, the more money you earn. For details on Earn Your Return, go to nmefcu.org or visit their branch on St. Michael's Drive.
And at noon on KSFR, now segues to today's feature stories. An audit report on the impact of child care and Head Start programs on student achievement concludes that basic child care fails to improve the later school performance and literacy of students. KSFR's Tom Trowbridge joins us now with this report.
Thanks, Dan. I'm with LFC Deputy Director Charles Salee. Charles, please highlight the key findings of the committee's program evaluation on New Mexico's preschool efforts.
First off, we're making a dent in making sure kids have an opportunity for preschool. Four-year-olds, we estimate between 60 and 70% of preschool-age kids are enrolled in one type of publicly funded program, whether it's our state pre-K program, whether it's child care assistance or Head Start. The disappointing conclusion that the report drew was that a lot of those kids are not being better prepared for kindergarten, and we're not seeing the long-term positive outcomes that we need to by third grade. The good news is that kids that participate in pre-K, we are seeing those good results, and that gives us an opportunity to take a look at how to continue to expand that program and really expand the program standards for pre-K to other publicly funded programs serving four-year-olds.
The report suggests the state coordinate all child care and pre-kindergarten programs to see that these taxpayer-funded programs meet basic state standards for preschools. Can you provide more details on this suggestion?
Basically, what we'd like to see happen is if you're a Head Start agency, you're licensed by the state, you're serving four-year-olds, we want you to follow our state standards and really working with those agencies and with the federal government to make sure that we can do that. The same thing with child care assistance. If a mother's getting a subsidy for child care assistance and has a four-year-old, how to steer that family into a high-quality pre-kindergarten program, likely offered by a child care center. So we wouldn't be taking money away from child care centers. We'd be raising the quality of programming that they're offering to low-income families.
The audit indicates that New Mexico spent 44% more money in recent years for child care and preschool efforts. What does this report tell us about the results of this increased public expenditure?
The good news coming out of the recession has been the state's been making major investments and broadly in a core set of early childhood programs beyond just child care assistance. So that includes doubling our pre-K investment, a 50% increase in another program called Kindergarten 3 Plus that extends the school year. We've seen positive results out of that program. Large increases in child care assistance, the governor's initiatives with Reads to Lead. So it's a broad core set of early childhood programs where we've been making major investments. Where we're not seeing the results right now is with the investments in child care assistance and with the federal investments in Head Start.
Is the Legislative Finance Committee suggesting legislation to remedy the issues identified in the report?
So staff have recommended two pieces of legislation. One would be to raise the bar on child care quality and accountability overall. The other would be for Head Start accountability and quality, where we would set requirements in place for agencies that are getting state funding to come under our state early childhood system, even if they're getting Head Start money directly from the federal government. We think that's one angle that we'd like to explore while Congress weighs whether or not to grant states waivers to manage those funds in that program, which seems unlikely in the near term.
And Charles, is there anything else you'd like our listeners to know about the report on the impact of child care and Head Start programs on student achievements?
I think it offers a pretty good baseline understanding about where we're at and a roadmap for how to continue to improve outcomes for very young kids. We know that schools face an extraordinary challenge. With the available data we have, 25% of kids are showing up to kindergarten and can't recognize one letter. 80% of our low-income kids, which constitutes the vast majority of kids going to kindergarten, show up far behind their more affluent peers. And so that, in order to try to close that gap, we need to make sure that the investments we're already making are paying off. And then I think we can have success by the time they get to third grade.
Charles Salee of the New Mexico Legislative Finance Committee. For KSFR News, I'm Tom Trowbridge.
The Lenzik proudly presents the Hungarian State Folk Ensemble with an evening of traditional dance and music from Hungary on Thursday, October 3rd at 7:30. Based in Budapest, these dancers and musicians share their country's lively, colorful traditions. For tickets to the Hungarian State Folk Ensemble on October 3rd, call 988-1234 or visit ticketsantafe.org. The Lenzik is a nonprofit, member-supported organization.
14 minutes past the hour as At Noon on KSFR continues. It was once named America's most endangered waterway, but folks strolling along the Santa Fe River these days have noticed a change. There is a genuine flow of water in it. Joining us now to talk about where the water is coming from and why is Brian Dreipolcher, the River and Watershed Coordinator for Santa Fe. Brian, in addition to running water in the riverbed, what else might Santa Feans notice?
Sometimes I can attempt to wax a little bit poetic about this. You know, if there's water running in the river, to me they'll notice our wonderful fall sunshine sparkling off the water as it flows by, and they'll hear the babbling brook that is sometimes the Santa Fe River that we get to enjoy that way.
And why is the river flowing right now?
Well, there's a couple things going on, a few reasons. One, the city has something on the books called the Target Flow Ordinance, and that's where our city has decided through reservoir management, we will, to some quantity of water, provide for flows in the Santa Fe River. So effectively what we've done is added a component to our reservoir management, where really since the late 1800s, reservoir management has been focused on getting water into a pipe for municipal water supply. Well, there's this new component to reservoir management, which is to put water in the river. So there's an allocation of water for river flows. It's 1,000 acre feet per year, except when there's a forecast of, let's say, a reduced forecast of flows coming out of the Santa Fe River watershed. You know, if we have a drought year and things aren't looking so good for what's going to come out of the watershed, then we reduce that target flow commitment. So our target flow commitment this year is for 320 acre feet for the year. And right now, those flows going through town are to meet that, I guess, kind of a obligation for that 320 acre feet in the Santa Fe River for this water year. With these rains, back on September 12th, our upper reservoir, which is McClure Reservoir, that's the bigger one, was at about 30% capacity. Once we started getting the rains after September 12th, we've now bumped up to over 80% capacity, which is great news. It's wonderful to have that water in storage. On the other hand, you don't necessarily want a full reservoir. You want to have the capacity to catch water. You want to have capacity to catch new rainwater safely. Going into the winter, the Water Division likes to draw down the reservoirs a little bit, so you have a little cushion in there to accept spring runoff. So there are all these variables that will go into how much water will continue to be passed down the river, how much water will go into the treatment system. But most of it will likely be captured for the treatment system. And as I say, in a couple of weeks here, we'll start to see little or no water flowing through town.
And the second reason it's running?
We have the target flow ordinance, and we're working on that flow commitment. We've also had fantastic rains. You know, it's not raining today and not for the last few days, but we've had great moisture in town and up in the upper watershed. So we have the water availability. There's work going on at Nichols Reservoir, and that work is to replace the outlet tower, the concrete tower that stands out more or less in the middle of the reservoir, and it's got some drains and valves in it. And you open those valves, and water flows into the tower. I'm kind of simplifying how this works, but flows into the tower and flows into a pipe and goes to our water treatment plant. And that tower is decades old and soon would likely become unsafe for the people who need to work in and around that tower, so it's being replaced. And in order to replace a concrete tower that stands out in the middle of the reservoir, the city needs to empty that reservoir. So the water that's flowing out of the upper watershed is basically flowing through a mostly empty Nichols Reservoir and flowing on down into town. So we've had great rain, we have the target flow ordinance, and we have this infrastructure, much needed infrastructure work going on at Nichols Reservoir. With all those things, three things combined, we've got water in our river.
What are the plans for replacing the structure?
Rather than a vertical tower standing up in the center of the reservoir, this won't be so much a tower as a tunnel laying against the face of the dam, a sort of a sloping tunnel with a stairway in it. So the people that need to get into that those outlet works can just walk down that stairway, work on the pipe, work on the valves, work on the drains. Much safer condition, much more accommodating condition for the folks that need to work on that. You know, with the current system, to get out to the tower, you get in a little boat, or if wintertime and there's ice on the reservoir, you get a little riskier to get out there and work on things if you need to work on them.
How long will the current river flow last?
It's going to run another couple of weeks. So part of the process for the work at the reservoir now is to kind of rig a temporary or interim system of catchment and pipes so that we can get the Canyon Road treatment plant back online. So right now, any water coming through Nichols needs to bypass right on through Nichols. But with an interim kind of system rigged up there, the water division will be able to get water into a pipe and get it into the Canyon Road treatment system. So we'll be back online with providing the city with drinking water from our watershed.
You mentioned the McClure Reservoir. Can you tell us about the plans for work on it?
Yes, that'll be round two. Round one is the outlet works at Nichols. That's the lower, smaller reservoir. And then when Nichols is back online and fully operational, it'll be time to move up the watershed and basically do the same thing at McClure.
Anything else you'd like our listeners to know?
I think one thing is for the people of Santa Fe to stay focused on water conservation. When we had the drought 2001-2002, over the period of the next 5 years after 2002, the people of Santa Fe reduced their per capita consumption by almost 40%, which is huge if you think about it. Each homeowner, each resident, just by heightening their awareness and changing the way we do things a little bit, reduced per person consumption by 40%. That's huge. So for all of us to keep thinking about conservation is important.
Brian Dreipulcher, River and Watershed Coordinator for Santa Fe, many thanks for joining us here at noon on KSFR, which continues in just a moment.
From farm to feast, the Santa Fe Farmers Market Institute hosts the 7th annual Fall Fiesta Gala on Saturday, October 5th at 6 p.m., featuring local harvest food prepared by 12 celebrity chefs, live and silent auctions, and music by the Straight Up Jazz Trio. Proceeds benefit the Farmers Market. To learn more or make reservations, visit farmersmarketinstitute.org or call 983-7726. A message from the nonprofit Santa Fe Farmers Market Institute.
12:23 here in the KSFR newsroom as At Noon continues. KSFR news reporter Marion Cox has often provided us with detailed reports of significant doings in Santa Fe County. She joins us now by phone to give the preamble for the next feature. Marion, give us an overview of this report.
Dan, thanks so much. We had an opportunity this week to sit down with Catherine Miller, the Santa Fe County manager. This was a rare interview. Catherine rarely sits down with the media. She says she likes to stay below the radar. And we also spoke with an important member of her administrative staff, Adam Liegeland. Adam is the Director of Public Works for Santa Fe County. And the reason that Catherine asked Adam to join us is because one of the most important things that the county has been working on in past months and will continue to work on is updating its capital improvements planning process.
All right. Thank you, Marion. And we now bring you the first installment of Marion's interview with Santa Fe County Manager Catherine Miller and County Director of Public Works Adam Liegland.
Catherine, if you don't mind, let's start with just a general question. What is the state of Santa Fe County right now, financially and otherwise? Are we in pretty good shape? Have we survived the recession? What's your take on where the county is?
Well, I would say that the county is in pretty good shape. I think we have come out of the recession for the most part. We're in the black. We have a balanced budget. Our recurring revenues equal our recurring expenditures. And what we've been able to do is where we've been able to make cuts and be conservative on our expenditure side or even conservative on estimating revenues, we've been able to have some surplus at the end of the year that we've been able to put into improving county facilities. That's playing out in being able to provide better road maintenance through better equipment for our road maintenance crews, actually getting into our facilities and being able to do improvements in our facilities where they had been somewhat neglected because of the economic downturn.
County Manager Miller, along with her Director of Public Works for the county, Adam Liegland, spoke to us next about current efforts to improve and update capital improvement planning processes for the county. Adam, maybe share with our listeners why they should even care about capital improvement planning. It seems so esoteric and out of the normal person's range of interest, and yet it really does have an impact on every single tax dollar and tax payment that residents make.
Well, I would go beyond that and just say it's really, in a lot of ways, through county capital assets that county constituents interact with the county. Every county resident drives on a county road. The capital improvement planning process, you say it's esoteric, and maybe that's one of the problems. In fact, we mentioned transparency a couple of times, and one of our goals is to make this process transparent, because at the end of the day, it's really not that complicated. You know, the first step really is to identify what county priorities are, because capital assets are really just a way for us to meet county goals. So the first thing to do, and that comes out of the Sustainable Growth Management Plan, you'll see it articulated out there, is to identify what county policies and programs are.
And so this really is a difference from the way business has been done in the county in the past, in that you're linking, in one instance at least, the Sustainable Growth Management Plan and the accompanying land use code with the way you prioritize the use of those tax dollars for capital improvement planning and public works?
Exactly. And so just to give you an idea, we have identified 410 individual needs for a total need of $420 million. So that's the first step. And each one of these is a linkage to some sort of county goal. So we have a six-step scoring algorithm that was identified that we've been working on, and it says, is it in a plan? Is it identifying a life health and safety issue? Is it, do we have some sort of, does the EPA say we have to fix this because we're violating?
The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency.
Exactly, or the state environmental department saying we have to fix it. So we have a six-factor scoring algorithm.
And let me stop you right there, because that right there is a huge move forward for the county, is it not?
Yes, it's a somewhat a technocratic, if you will, scoring algorithm.
The ones that will end up getting funded first are going to be the ones that have possibly some regulatory issues to address, life safety issues to address, a high need.
You identified that you have a list of 420-plus projects. What's an estimate of how many of those may be funded in the next year?
We really do our capital improvement planning over a four-year cycle because, you know, you have to do design, and there's phasing and all this other stuff. So we really look over 4 years of our execution timeline. That's what the term we use. So over 4 years, it's going to be about maybe $50 million. So that's, you know, that's 10% of the total need over 4 years.
The planning process itself has been greatly updated and modernized. What about the procurement process? Catherine, I know when you first came in as the county manager almost 3 years ago, you came in a whirlwind of issues. Procurement was part of the issue 3 years ago. Has the procurement process for any or all of these capital improvement projects changed in any substantial way?
Yes, we've made several changes to our procurement ordinance. We've made changes in the process that we follow. We've got quite a few different avenues of looking for some ways to expedite things, but to make sure that they're done without cutting corners, and that would get us into any kind of legal issues.
That report from KSFR's Marion Cox. And we'll bring you part two of Marion's interview with Santa Fe County Manager Catherine Miller and County Director of Public Works Adam Liegland in tomorrow's At Noon here on KSFR. That opens with an installment on an improvement in transparency in county government. More of At Noon coming up for you in just a moment.
KSFR programming is underwritten in part by PNM, who recently brought the Prosperity Energy Storage Project online. The project allows PNM to store solar energy, helping to provide consistent solar power even on cloudy days. This is the first solar storage plant integrated into the grid in the nation. If you have a question for PNM, you can talk to them on Twitter or Facebook, or visit PNM online at pnm.com.
Just before we went to air, we caught up with Santa Fe Community College President Dr. Anna Cha Guzman, who at this moment is greeting the Mexican consul as they introduce a new program. Here is a discussion of today's noontime event. Today on campus, something very exciting is happening. The Mexican Ministry of Foreign Affairs has established a new scholarship program. You are about to have a meeting on this. Tell us what's going on.
Yes. Well, the Mexican consulate has awarded us $10,000, which Santa Fe Community College will match. So there will be a $20,000 scholarship fund, especially for Mexican Americans and for Mexicans. And the many consulates throughout the world have established this. Germany has invested lots of money in their own people. And Mexico now is doing it, which we find really a great idea for them, because we have many students who may be here with the I-2 visas or not. And the consulate understood that and wanted to provide the scholarships that would allow some of their Mexican students and some of our Mexican-American students to get these, and in Spanish you call them becas, scholarships.
And who made the initial outreach for this? Was it something that was promoted here from the campus first, or were you approached by the ministry?
It was Mr. Jeff Case, who is on the Grow Foundation. And he has international ties, and he brought the idea to me about a year ago and to Deborah Bolt, the executive director, and said, the consulate is thinking about doing it. Should we work with them? And I said, absolutely. The need is here, and we would welcome to have that special relationship with the consulate. So Mr. Case followed the process, and we generated a proposal, and we have just been awarded the $10,000, and that will become $20,000. And that's really substantial for a community college, because our tuition and fees are still low, and so we will be able to fund many students for that 1 year.
And the students who might benefit from this, have they already been identified or targeted, or will you now begin to look at who is eligible?
No, now we will begin to look at it. I will go into Spanish radio and TV to advertise, and we will look for the students, and we may have many of them at the college. Where they are getting loans, they will be able to attend college with becas, scholarships.
Dr. Guzman, I know that you're racing. You have to meet with the Mexican consul for the announcement of the scholarship program, but many thanks for joining us here in studio at KSFR today.
You're welcome.
12:33 as At Noon continues. Senator Tom Udall spoke this morning to the potential for a government shutdown and its impact to New Mexico.
I want to give you an update on the situation here in Congress. Last Friday, the House passed a temporary spending bill that is unacceptable to me for a couple of reasons. It defunds the Affordable Care Act, and it locks in sequestration. And now we're in an incredibly frustrating situation where the federal government will shut down on October 1st if we can't agree. The small minority of Republicans here have ground everything to a halt just to prove a point about Obamacare. What makes it even worse is that this is all for show. Health care will still go into effect on October the 1st. The government shutdown would be incredibly destructive to New Mexico, especially our national labs, military bases, the waste isolation pilot project, and public land agencies. It also would come when the state badly needs federal assistance to recover from the storms. I'm pretty tired of these threats, and I know New Mexicans are too. We need to concentrate on making the health care law the best it can be, not threaten to run the government off the cliff, along with our economy and the health and well-being of millions of Americans. I'm doing everything I can to prevent this. New Mexico has about 27,000 federal civilian employees, more military members, and thousands of other contract employees. I'm co-sponsoring a bill to ensure our military and National Guard members get their paychecks on time in the event of a government shutdown. Our military families sacrifice enough. They shouldn't have to suffer from dysfunction in Washington. Now, I'm optimistic, actually. I think the Senate will pass a bill, keep the government open, and allow the health care law to go forward. But the reality is that when we move past this crisis, there's another one waiting over whether to raise the debt limit. And sequestration continues to take its toll on New Mexico and the rest of the country. We can't keep governing like this. Funding the government in short-term bursts is doing real damage to our economy and our communities. In New Mexico, for example, Sandia needs more than just a flat appropriation. The future of the B-61 program, which keeps our nuclear weapons stockpile safe and protects our nation's security, depends on getting additional money. Countless contractors that do work for the federal government, they need certainty. Employers don't hire for 75 days. Contractors need time to prepare for jobs or look elsewhere. And as a member of the Appropriations Committee, I'm talking with my colleagues constantly to try to find common ground so we can move past these fights. I spoke on the floor earlier today about how devastating this budget dysfunction is to our economy. I want to send a message. Congress needs to do its job and get back to the following. And Congress needs to do its job and get back to following the regular appropriations process. We need to give federal agencies and the thousands of contractors who work with the federal government the opportunity to plan and ensure taxpayer money is being spent carefully and thoughtfully.
New Mexico Senator Tom Udall. There's a new texting service available for teens. Here with the story is KSFR News reporter Charles Maynard.
There's been much discussion about the inappropriate use of social media by teenagers. Now there's a positive use of texting that helps answer teens' questions about sex in an appropriate manner. Valerie Fisher is with the New Mexico Department of Health.
Well, the Birds and Bees, it's a national text line system that offers teens and parents free, confidential, and accurate answers to sexual health questions in either English or Spanish. Parents will also receive recommendations on ways that they can increase their skills in talking to their teens about sexual health. Teens from ages 13 to 19 can text NMTeen to 66746, and parents can text NMParent to the same short code, 66746.
The service provides answers to a number of topics.
Well, they cover sexual health questions, relationships, bodies, and safety questions. For example, am I normal, kind of anatomical questions, how to get birth control, how pregnancy occurs, how HIV and STDs are contracted, where can I get tested. As far as relationships, you know, how to know if someone likes you, how to ask someone out on a date, and also what to do if a partner mistreats you. So it covers kind of like the whole realm of sexual relationship.
The program does not answer how-to questions. there have been a few negative comments about the service.
You know, we've had a few comments on the text line. I think a lot of it is miscommunication. What I've heard is, you know, some parents may feel that it's an invasion of privacy, it's a government application, and which it is not. It is a system that the government is providing. It's a service that we're providing to the public. They can use it if they choose to, and of course they don't have to use it if they don't want to. It was intended to answer questions from teens regarding sexual health that persuade them to talk to their parents or a trusted adult if they have a question or a concern. But in the instance where they don't have or feel comfortable talking to a parent or trusted adult, you know, they can text in a question and it's anonymous.
The program is paid for from a few sources.
We have a contract with the organization that provides the service. About half of the funding comes from a federal grant, and the other half comes from state general funds.
Valerie Fisher with the Department of Health. For KSFR News, I'm Charles Maynard.
12:40 here in the KSFR newsroom, and that is the perfect time to spend 60 seconds with our resident curmudgeon, Christopher Hagen.
Well, on 60 Seconds, we seemingly deal with mostly lighthearted subjects. Some perceptive scholars in this country and abroad have recognized how each 60 Seconds episode carries profundity. Incidentally, Brigham Young University will receive the first batch of 60 Seconds episodes, recorded in 1914. Regardless of the history of frivolity on 60 Seconds, today we will turn to the subject of Syria. While any war, inadvertently or too often on purpose, kills innocents, after World War I, a global ban on chemical weapons was agreed upon, chemical weapons being, when used, insidious and pervasive and indiscriminate. My solution to Syria and its chemical weapons stockpile and its civil war: force-feed me beans and cabbage for a week and then drop me into the middle of Damascus. End of problem. And technically, it would not be chemical warfare. For KSFR, I'm Christopher Hagen.
And with that, we'll conclude today's edition of At Noon, KSFR's extended noon news hour. Dan Garrity with you here at the news desk, with many thanks to my contributing colleagues today, Tom Trowbridge, Marion Cox, and Charles Maynard.